Hello and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast, Episode 16, Interlude the Second. James Francis Edward Stuart arrived in Avignon in April 1716. Under the protection of Pope Clement XI, he and his court were installed in a Hotel de la Serre, the official residence of the Papal Guard Commander. Forced to start from scratch, James reconstructed his court here, and it eventually swelled to close to 500 people, including the Earl of Mar and the Earl of Ormond, who followed their king. The main build-up of people were refugees from England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland, whom James tried to support, albeit in extremely limited fashion, with limited resources, distributing a form of pension which he received in funding from France. Whilst his supporters were locked in prison and facing a death penalty, James was focusing his attention on trying to recapture his throne. Now, for the time being, France was out of the picture, thanks to the continuing state of peace between Britain and King Louis, so James had to look further afield for potential partners in his revolution. It is these particular ventures that will make up the first part of this interlude. You see, at the time, whilst George and Louis were at peace, Hanover was in a war with mainland Europe. This had been going on since at least 1708, when Sweden, at the time known more for being an imperial power, had been suffering against others trying to take their land, losing two entire provinces to Russia. Sensing blood in the water, George had sent his Hanoverian troops to occupy Bremen and Werder, two towns in modern-day Germany that were under Swedish control and prized for their taxes and tariffs that the occupier could levy on shipping and transit. Hanover allied with Russia, Poland, Prussia, Denmark and Saxony against Sweden in what was known as the Great Northern War, and decided, albeit without making it public, to utilise the Royal Navy to harass Swedish shipping, even though this in itself was a flagrant violation of British laws, given that the Act of Settlement forbade involvement in foreign war. Sweden, understandably vexed by this, looked at a way to get back at the Hanoverian King of Britain. Sweden and its King Charles must have thought they'd found the answer with James Stuart and the Jacobites. This saga in history is commonly known as the Gillenborg Plot. And whilst the details aren't exactly as fleshed out as other campaigns, there is intercepted correspondence that helps show what the main plan was. The Swedish ambassador, Count Carl Gillenborg, would canvass Jacobite supporters in Britain and seek funding from them. Once enough funding was raised, correspondence suggests it would have been around 60,000, then the Swedish army would send 10 to 12,000 troops to Britain to help the Jacobites restore James to the throne. By canvassing the Jacobites in secret, Gillenborg had convinced them to raise nearly £18,000. But the British government had a formidable intelligence arm, and by the autumn of 1716, they knew that the Swedes were conspiring and roughly who was involved. By the start of 1717, they were ready to act and go in hard. On January the 29th, 1717, General George Wade, at the head of a group of troops, arrested Gillenborg and seized his personal papers. Whilst this was a massive violation of the principle of diplomatic immunity, the Hanoverians doubled down on this and announced all the lurid details in a very public trial. Now, eventually Gillenborg was sent back to Sweden, but given the very public nature of the plot now, British troops and ships could now be deployed against Swedish forces in the Baltic, as rather than a foreign conflict, now the spectre of the Stuart and Jacobite Restoration had made this a direct threat to the British crown. Now, in all seriousness, it's probably never really got beyond the fundraising stage, but there was an effort to do something. It remains one of the great what-ifs of British history if King Charles of Sweden had actually gone ahead with a proper military invasion, rather than just holding the threat of a Jacobite restoration over the British for concessions on the continent, and if perhaps they had used a more secure messaging service rather than the usual British post, which was well intercepted by the Hanoverians. But it seems that King Charles hadn't known about the Gillenborg plot directly, but that he was still furious that his ambassador had been arrested. But for the rest of 1717, nothing concrete came of it. And then in 1718, in December, King Charles XII of Sweden was killed whilst overseeing a siege at Fredriksten, now near modern-day Norway. The Jacobites had, however, this time decided not to throw their eggs in one basket. And having got nowhere with Sweden, they approached other great nations in Europe, namely Russia and Spain. Russia, beginning its rise to imperial greatness with Peter the Great, fourth in what would become the Russian Romanov dynasty, Peter was laying the foundations of the Russian Empire. He and James got on rather well, even to the point that Peter offered his own 10-year-old daughter for marriage to ally the Romanovs to the House of Stuart. But this was politely declined by James, given that she was Russian Orthodox and the marriage would hinge on Sweden restoring James. As we've discussed, the Swedish plotting had came to nothing, so this Romanov-Stuart Grand Alliance will have to reside in the file marked Great What-Ifs of Jacobite History, along with the Gillenborg plot being successful. James had by now had to flee Avignon in February 1717, after King George piled pressure on the Duc d'Orléans and Louis XV to remove this threat to his reign from their adjacent territory. Now, still under papal protection, Clement XI offered James and his court further protection in the Papal State in Italy. James, travelling under a false name, arrived in Rome in May to be gifted a 12,000 scudi pension and a palace in Urbino. But just because he was safely ensconced in the Pope's backyard doesn't mean James gave up on his restoration and instead focused on fostering a relationship with Spain. Despite also being from the House of Bourbon, King Philip of Spain wished to remove the Duke d'Orléans and his nephew Louis's regent by either intrigue or murder, and it was the latter option that led to the geopolitical upheaval in which France, Britain and the Netherlands all declared war on Spain, starting what was known in history as the War of the Quadruple Alliance. Spain's Prime Minister, Cardinal Julio Alberoni, an Italian clergyman who'd gained the favour of King Philip's wife, had decided that, like the French before them, the Spanish would utilise the Jacobite threat to destabilise Britain. Their desired aim, however, was to depose George, send him back to Hanover, and install James as king in Britain, and use his friendship to remove British forces from the Quadruple Alliance, reducing it instead to a mere triple. 3, 2, 1. Alberoni had diverted some resources to fund James and his court in order to curry favour with the Stuarts to serve this very purpose. James had been having what many would probably describe as a very low period in his life. Losing his campaign against George in the 15, defeated and forced back to Europe, then exiled from Lorraine to Avignon, and from there to Urbino, even further from his homeland. To cap all of this, in May 1718, Mary of Modena, widow of the deposed James II and 7th, and James III's mother, died of cancer. Her last years had been rather miserable. Losing her son James to exile and his sister Louisa to smallpox, Mary was dependent on the nuns at the convent of the Visitations near Paris. Left destitute to the point she couldn't even afford horses for travel. With her passing, we bid farewell to the last of the original protagonists of the Jacobite saga. James lost his mother, who was also a loyal advisor, and during her regency, a savvy political operator. In a more pragmatic sense, James also lost out financially, as once Queen Mary had died, France decided it would no longer pay for her pension at court, or send it directly to James. This not only left James struggling to support his court and unable to do anything to help those who'd looked after his mother, it left most of those in Paris who had been her courtiers financially destitute. Given this series of setbacks and personal tragedies, it's no wonder that James was so keen to accept Alberoni's advances to mount a new uprising. Meetings between Alberoni and the Duke of Ormond fleshed out a plan that involved Ormond sailing an armada of ships to the Jacobite-sympathising port city of Bristol, whereupon they would land troops. In addition, George Keith, the Earl Marischal, would sail to Scotland to raise the clans for James. By the end of 1718, Alberoni invited James to Spain to coordinate the invasion forces. James had sailed there, but was blown off course to Marseille and had to be hidden and later laid up in France in bed with sickness. He eventually reached Spain in March 1719 to be received with full royal welcome, acknowledged as the true king of Great Britain and Ireland, and even the use of King Philip's own personal royal coach to take him to Madrid. James was entertained daily by the king and queen for dinner. After a week or so, he decided to head to the coast to see how his armada to invade England and take back his kingdom was doing. When he arrived in Coruña to see this fleet and sail to join them England, James was, once again in his life, due to be disappointed. Ormond had attempted to set sail for southwest England, but was blown off course by a vicious storm off the French coast in Brittany, where several ships were broken and supplies were depleted, forcing them to abort and return to Spanish ports. Not long after, the Earl Marischal, Lord George Murray, William Murray, the Marquess of Tullibardine, the Earl of Seaforth, and around 400 Spanish troops had sailed from Spain and France to land at Stornoway in the Isle of Lewis in Scotland. James, stranded in Coruña, was left awaiting news of his army's fate. The party that landed in Scotland had no idea that Ormond's larger force had been forced to turn back and was still stuck in Spain. Now that the Royal Navy had spotted the movements of troops and ships, the game was up, and what was to be the Scottish Second Front was now the entire Jacobite invasion force. This new invasion wasn't getting off to the best of starts, but once the Scottish landing team discovered the harsh reality that they were it now, there would be no help from England, and that they were on their own, they decided to try and make the best of it. So, resolving to salvage what could be seen as a really, really bad situation, the Scottish contingent pressed on with their attempt to raise rebellion in the Highlands. Marching by Loch Alsh, Spanish troops assaulted and captured Ilion Danann Castle, an iconic structure that sits on a small island and is easily one of the most photographed castles in the Highlands, occupying the fort with a garrison of around 40 to 50 men, whilst the remaining Spaniards and Jacobites linked up with around 500 Mackenzie men from the Earl of Seaforth's lands and other volunteers, and drafted tenants who answered the call. All in all, they numbered around 1,400 men marching toward Inverness. Now, the plan originally was for the Jacobite Spanish forces to march on Inverness and secure the city for use as a port for landing Swedish forces. The only problem with this was after Charles XII's death in December 1718, the Swedish had played no active part in any planning and were in no way involved in this current rising, nor were they going to be sending anyone. Regardless of this, William Murray, the Marquess of Tullibardine and the commander of Jacobite forces, rallied his men to press on. The month after the Jacobites seized Ilion Danann, three Royal Navy warships, the Worcester, the Enterprise and the Flamborough, anchored near the castle, and on May 10, 1719, sent boats to the island to attempt a negotiation. But the Spanish and Jacobite troops opened fire upon them. The naval envoys withdrew with haste, and then subjected the Jacobites and Spaniards to a naval bombardment from all three ships. After a couple of days of this, the Royal Navy stormed the castle and overwhelmed the defenders, placing them under arrest and shipping them to Edinburgh. The government then used some of the powder barrels captured from the Jacobites to detonate the castle, preventing it from being garrisoned again. Ilion Danann, incidentally, would stay in ruins for nearly 200 years until it was refurbished to its current state. The Jacobites on the march towards Inverness were pressing on, but the general in charge there, Joseph Whiteman, had known they were coming, rallied 1,000 or so troops of his own from the Highland companies, and headed off to confront the enemy. And so it was that British troops came upon the rebels of Glen Shiel on June 10, 1719. The rebels had deployed along the hillsides in the pass along Glen Shiel to receive the government forces from an elevated position. This would have probably been a very sensible idea had it not been for the fact that the British troops had brought with them artillery pieces in the form of Coehorn mortars. They were a lighter form of artillery, easier to carry, and they could deploy against siege walls, but here the mortars were aimed at the forces on the hills and proceeded to engage the Jacobites and the Spanish from a distance, bombarding them, as well as adding the psychological weapon of men being able to see the incoming shells from above and having absolutely nothing to be able to stop them with. Although the mortars killed relatively few people, the Highland troops hadn't experienced this and started to hide in their trenches and positions, allowing Whiteman's forces to advance up the hills and use their well-trained grenadiers to flush the Jacobites from their positions. This removed the threat of a flanking movement from the Jacobites, and despite spirited fighting from the Spanish troops, they eventually found themselves forced to retreat, surrendering to the government the next day, under the understanding that as troops of a foreign power, they would be treated as prisoners of war and shipped home. Lord George Murray, his brother the Marquess of Tullibardine, and Mackenzie of Seaforth were all wounded in the fighting, but given that they would be treated as rebels, and executed in all likelihood, they fled the field, hid, and escaped to France when it was safe. With the end of the Battle of Glen Shiel, this effectively ended the Rising of 1719. March 1719 was the closest James would come again to returning to Britain. A month later, British warships were sighted off the coast, and so James fled Coruña for further into the Spanish mainland. Upon hearing at the defeat of Glen Shiel, which unfortunately for him also happened on his birthday, James had decided to return to Italy. He had his dreams of returning crushed and his armies defeated on the field of battle again. William Murray, the Marquess of Tullibardine, wrote to Mar, the Jacobite Secretary of State in the aftermath, that it was a blow to the King and the people of Britain. By the end of the year, British naval troops captured the Spanish port of Vigo, looted the stores, burned buildings and warships, and returned to Britain with the spoils. This firmly ended Spanish military intrigue against the British, at least with the Jacobites. Cardinal Alberoni was dismissed as Prime Minister for his failures, removing a linchpin of Spanish Jacobite support. The 1719 uprising was doomed to failure once the main flotilla of Ormond was turned about by storms. Some could have argued that British intelligence were already warned, but landing only in Scotland and proceeding with the diversionary assault as the main assault, and the fact that the plan was still counting on a Swedish invasion fleet landing when the Swedes had never been involved in the current plan, didn't exactly cast a good shadow on things. This rising warrants mention for the Jacobite attempts to enlist the support of a power other than France, to try and overthrow the people who reigned over Britain. But much like the French, Spain didn't really commit what was necessary to mount a decent campaign, and once again the Jacobites were used as pawns in a much larger geopolitical conflict. The aim was to remove Britain from the War of the Quadruple Alliance, or cause so much trouble in Britain that they had to stop fighting. Spain's loss in this was shown they probably not in a position to front any more, and Cardinal Alberoni paid for this failure with his dismissal. Given its brevity, the 1719 Rising is often overlooked, but it's another stepping stone, showing the slowly reducing chances of James Francis Edward Stuart to reclaim his throne. James's return to Italy was a timely one, as there was another massive event in his life to come. He'd been betrothed to wed King John Sobieski of Poland's eldest granddaughter, Maria Clementina Sobieski, a slight, delicate and graceful 16-year-old girl with strong aristocratic connections. Clementina was transported to Rome to marry James and arrived in May when James was in Spain. Awaiting the arrival of her husband-to-be, Clementina had stayed at the convent of the Versalines on the Via Vittoria. While staying there, Clementina took advantage of the time to visit the chapels and show her devotion to God, Christ and the Virgin Mary, which impressed the nuns who hosted her, but also her godfather, Pope Clement XI. It had been an arduous journey for Clementina to marry James. Poland at the time, and the Sobieski family specifically, were subjects of the Holy Roman Empire, and its leader, Charles VI, was incidentally Clementina's first cousin, allowed her to be arrested en route to Rome after a request from George I of Britain, who was desiring a way to break up the marriage in any method possible to him. She was taken with her retinue and held in Innsbruck in modern-day Austria. Clementina would stay in Innsbruck until her family helped her escape with the aid of Charles Wogan, an Irish mercenary who'd served James in the 15 and been one of the handful of men who'd escaped from Newgate Prison with old Mackintosh of Borlam. Pretending to be an accomplice of the brother of the Countess of Cerne, who was in fact one of Wogan's co-conspirators, Wogan rode to Innsbruck and with a mix of subterfuge and guile snuck Princess Clementina from captivity to Italy, where Wogan was rewarded with a baronet by James and a position as a senator of Rome by the Pope. As was the custom with marriages of nobility at the time, James and Clementina had already been married by proxy, but had to wait until James returned to Italy from his failed Spanish venture. When he got there, to Montefiore in Italy, he met his bride, who was almost half his age. She was described as surpassing all expectations by the king. Observers, however, noticed that James appeared aged beyond his years, possibly from the stresses and strains of the ordeals of the 15 and 19, and, judging from a portrait of the occasion, the purple coat that he was wearing, mourning the loss of his mother, Mary of Modena. The Pope had awarded the newlywed couple a property on the Via de' Santi Apostoli, which you will often see named as either the Palazzo Muti or the Palazzo de Re in the histories. They're often used interchangeably, but I'll try and stick to the modern naming of Palazzo Muti, just to know if I say Palazzo del Re, it's the same place. The Pope also granted the couple the Palazzo Savelli, a summer residence near the Castel Gandolfo, which had been the summer residence of the Pope until recently when Pope Francis turned it into a museum. The couple stayed in Montefiascone for a short honeymoon, then established themselves in the Palazzo Mutti with the newly appointed 80,000 scudi papal pension and French and Spanish money coming in. James would establish what would be, bar a couple of blips, his permanent seat for the Jacobite court in exile. The court attracted Jacobite sympathisers from England, Scotland, and the European exiles, such as the Earl of Mar. Since the British government had no diplomatic ties to the Vatican, given that the Pope recognised James and not George as the rightful monarch of Great Britain, it often fell to the Stuart court to act as an unofficial embassy. Even some British subjects with money who were undertaking the Grand Tour, which was often a trip taken by moneyed young men when they came of age. They would travel Europe and absorb the great artworks and architectural wonders of antiquity. Some of them would decide to spend time with their fellow countrymen in Rome, and there were several Jacobites who existed as tour guides or intermediaries with the Italian authorities, or at this point the papal authorities, to assist their tourers on their journeys. James would entertain high society with concerts and dancing held almost weekly at the palace. James and Clementina were delighted to announce that in 1720 they were expecting a child. James was in good spirits, and so were the Jacobites, with the expected arrival of a new heir to the throne. James excitedly awaited his new child, saying to friends that Clementina was as big as a house. Side note here, if your significant other is pregnant, telling them that they may be as big as a house probably will warrant you a smack in the mouth. The family and the court believed it would probably be a 1721 arrival, especially as on Boxing Day, Clementina had gone into false labour. But on New Year's Eve 1720, Clementina gave birth in front of an assembled nobility, which was James's way of guaranteeing nobody this time could question the legitimacy of a Stuart heir, as they had with him. The child was a healthy baby boy, and he was christened Charles Edward Louis John Casimir Sylvester Severino Maria Stuart. The Pope ordered a celebratory mass, and the cannons at the papal fortress of Castel Sant'Angelo were fired to mark the occasion. The Jacobite lineage had a new heir to the throne. The struggle for the British crown would carry on for the foreseeable future. Next time, we'll look at the early life of Prince Charles Stuart, the trials and tribulations of the Hanoverian monarchs, and events from the 1720s leading to the 1740s, when, in the words of the Jacobite song, the king may have his own again.